pianists are the worst timekeepers. We cannot keep a steady beat because we always play by ourselves. And when you play with a group, you have to keep up. So if we have our piano students play in a group together, they have to really count, really count.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
G'day everyone, and welcome back to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. You're listening to episode number 106, and if you're one of my Inner Circle Piano Teaching community members, a very special welcome to you. My name is Tim Topham, your host for the show, and if this is your first time here, thank you so much for tuning in. Great to have you joining us. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is a place where you can get weekly inspiration, ideas, business, and teaching strategies to help support and teach to help support your teaching and grow your studio. Remember that the best place to listen to podcasts like this is actually on your phone or tablet. As you drive, cook, exercise, or walk the dog, just use the podcast app on your phone, search for Creative Piano, and subscribe. You'll be automatically notified when new episodes go live. And thanks to everyone who has left reviews on my Facebook page and iTunes. I really appreciate all your feedback. And so if you're enjoying this podcast but haven't yet left a review somewhere, please take a few minutes to do this, as it's a great way to support my work and the ongoing development of this show. To find out how to do that, I've got some instructions for you at timtopham.com/review. Today's show notes and a full transcript, as usual, are going to be available at timtopham.com/episode106. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is brought to you by the Inner Circle, the world's leading professional development and training community for piano teachers. Inner Circle members get access to an extensive library of courses, teaching videos, lesson plans, and downloads that cover everything you need to know, not only to teach piano creatively and inspire students of all ages and abilities, but also to support you in building and growing your own studio. On top of that, you get access to our monthly online masterminds, exclusive member discounts on products, services, software, and sheet music, plus our active community forums, where you not only get advice and input from me, but also from hundreds of fellow piano teachers and my handpicked team of experts from around the world. So if you're serious about expanding your teaching repertoire, learning the best strategies to motivate and inspire students while growing a thriving studio, the Inner Circle is your place to be. Find out more at timtopham.com/community, and remember that you can use the code PIANOPODCAST as a thank you to take $100 off an annual subscription, which is locked in for the life of your membership. On to today's show. One of the things kids miss out on in traditional lessons is community. And I've talked about this with a number of people in the past, that opportunity to hang out with friends, share experience, play together, and, you know, have a little bit of friendly competition too. And it's why music lessons are so different to the school environment where students are spending most of their day. And of course, it's one of the focuses that we're looking at this month on the blog and the podcast, is this whole idea of group teaching, getting groups of students together in a room to not only learn piano or learn music, but to have fun and build that sense of community as well. Some teachers are changing this paradigm, and as you've hopefully read in some of the articles already from this month, it's becoming much more popular to teach in groups. And the reason is because it's actually having some great success. My guest on the show today is a world specialist on keyboard ensembles, and that's groups of students all playing digital instruments together, just like members of a band. She owns an innovative piano studio for children of all ages in Denton, Texas, where acoustic and digital instruments receive equal opportunity. She has composed piano solos and duets for Alfred Publishing and writes digital solos, duets, and keyboard ensembles for Ogilvy Music. She holds a BME and an MME from the University of North Texas. Welcome to the show, Susan Ogilvy.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I was just talking before I pressed record about how you've got a number of fans. We've got lots of fans around the world, but I get to meet a couple of them when I was at the 88 Creative Keys workshops in Denver, of course, and a number of people there told me about you and all the great things that you're doing. So it was only appropriate to have you on the show, particularly this month as we focus on group teaching. So I found a quote on your site which really appeals to my own ideas of teaching kids differently. And I want to actually read it out so you can talk to us a little bit more about it. You title the page, "The Uncommon Piano Teacher." And you say, "But really, it's more than all that. It's the ability and the desire to think outside the box. We take a chance and try something new. We teach on the edge, always stretching the boundaries of the ordinary lesson." Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail." This is the mantra of the uncommon piano teacher. So firstly, tell us, what's this idea of the uncommon piano teacher that you've written about a number of times on your site?
Well, it's a teacher who is open to everything. You know, so many teachers teach in the box, what we call in the box, either the way they learned, you know, 100 years ago or whatever, or the way...
Well, not 100 years ago. I don't know what you mean.
Well, you know, that's what I tell my kids. Oh, you're that old? Oh, yes. I always say, we had a piano in our cave, you know. That gets their attention anyway. But I think if we're always open to new ideas and, you know, don't remain closed, then we become better and we can reach our students where they really are. So
yes. And you wrote that in 2015. Do you think this approach and this idea is finally becoming more common now?
Yeah, I think it's going to take quite a while longer, because actually we've been doing like keyboard ensembles and group piano. Well, group piano has been around really actually for over 100 years, but it kind of came into full swing in the, I guess, the 40s, 1940s, and then really took a big leap in the 60s and 70s. And the late 60s and 70s was when I got into it. But I think now it's even more important than ever before, mainly because of two things. One thing is because of social media, because so many teachers are able to share their own ideas all the time. All you have to do is get on Facebook or other sites like your own and discover what lots of teachers are doing all over the world. And we aren't relying anymore solely on conventions, conferences, you know, and workshops sponsored mainly by publishers like we were for a long time. You're way too young to know about all that, but
that's very kind of you.
Yeah. But nearly every teacher has a creative idea, I think, that comes from his or her own experience and trying to solve some problem. So now they can share that.
I've never really considered group piano being around in the 1940s. What did that look like? I've really thought of it more as a digital piano thing in the sort of 80s and 70s.
Uh-huh. There was a fellow, and I've just seen a clip of his when I studied at North Texas at the university, who taught piano on TV, if you can believe that. He had mainly adult students and some kids that would tune in to his TV show, and he would show them one concept or one element of teaching piano.
Really? I had no idea.
Pretty neat. But, and you know, the TV was just kind of coming into its own, of course, in the late 40s and 50s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
there you go. And you said that even 100 years ago, were there people doing things with groups of pianos?
Uh-huh. They were small groups, but a lot of people think that piano was always taught individually, but it was initially taught in small groups.
Right.
So, like acoustic pianos. So it has a longer history than we think of. Mm. So
could you tell us a little bit about what your teaching looks like today? So sort of the ages and numbers that you teach and those sorts of things.
Well, it's different for me right now because I kind of took a hiatus, you'd say, from teaching in 2001, 2002, when I started traveling full-time for Yamaha all over the country. And I gave up my studio to a couple of teachers and just really pretty much stopped teaching. But I had a pretty large studio. I had two piano labs, and I had a room with a grand and an acoustic, and I had a computer lab. And I had a keyboard orchestra lab, so I had a pretty good size studio. So anyway, that being said, I've come full circle now. So I'm back in a attached room to our, a great big room to our home that we totally remodeled to teach in. So I'm back in my house.
Back at it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love it because I'm a lot more laid back,
yep,
so to speak. And of course I find that the kids are all, they're so different now. You know, I'm teaching the grandkids of some of the people that I taught, and of course some of the kids, and the kids are just a lot different. They have what you'd call, I didn't make this term up, but it's used now. They have a different listening space because of technology. They come in having heard demos from their portable keyboards, and, you know, they want to play the little hook from the video, some video games they're playing, and things like that. So they're a lot different. So I think we have to adjust, and it just forces us to have more fun.
That's right. And going outside the comfort zone, I really encourage teachers to do that. Even if you're unsure of what's going to happen, I find that students, they respect that you're trying new things and that you don't know all the answers and that you're kind of learning with them. And they respect you for that.
Yeah, they do. And you get their attention that way. And gosh, we need to keep, you know, we need to keep our students. There's a not so good statistic in the United States anyway, that 2/3 of our kids quit piano by their third year. So
yeah, it's really sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you taught in group originally? I'm always interested to know how people get into the way that they teach.
Well, that's a long story. I'll make it real short.
Great.
When I was, I got my bachelor's at North Texas, I was going to start working on my master's, and I had the opportunity to become what they call part-time faculty. Now they call that adjunct faculty. And in order to do that, I had to teach. I taught a little bit privately. And another option was to teach functional piano, which I did. And another one was to teach class piano. So I kind of was real hesitant about that. And my wonderful teacher said, then that's what you'll do. You'll learn how to teach class piano. We had 24 Wurlitzers in our Wurlitzer piano lab there at North. And so I took a summer kind of initiation class, and that was one of the hardest and best things that I ever did, because I learned kind of the basics of teaching group. A lot of people think you just walk around and give individual lessons, but it's not that at all. So that was a great training ground for me. I had an overhead projector, and the Wurlitzer lab then had its own communication system built within the piano. And I had a visualizer and all those things. And after a couple of semesters, I thought, gosh, this would be great fun to do with little kids, because I really enjoyed working with little kids. So I bought a lab of my own, and I did my master's thesis on teaching group piano and to preschool kids. So it just kind of evolved, and it kept growing and growing and growing. And I got my master's, started working on my doctorate, but my home studio with my piano lab kept growing and growing, and I just never looked back.
It becomes hard to do a PhD when life gets in the way.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about keyboard ensembles specifically today. I kind of see them as part of a group lesson. So there might be some instruction, and then at some stage, everyone's going to be playing together. Do you see it in the same way, or am I thinking of it the wrong way? Is keyboard ensemble a whole different type of lesson experience?
Well, that's just a great question. I think it, to me, it's kind of like it's threefold. And I started writing ensembles as a response from teaching in the group, because it occurred to me I had to teach all these kids at North Texas. I mainly got the kids who couldn't pass, or who were working on passing their piano barrier. You know, you have to pass a piano proficiency to graduate from music school. Everybody has to play piano. So I was taking them through all the drills to do that. And I thought, gosh, we're here to make music, you know, this, duh. So why can't, before we leave the class each day, why can't we all play a song together, everybody at their own skill level? And so that's when I started writing ensembles. And that's how that got started. But since then, of course, it's really evolved. I think it's an integral part of a class lesson, a group lesson, just even if it takes 2 minutes to play something together, to make a piece of music together. And also, it's, I think another, I guess, aspect of it is something that grew in my later studio when I had my great big studio. I had a separate ensemble rehearsal with four different groups of my piano students once a week, just like kids who study flute, clarinet, whatever, they go to a band rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So I thought, gosh, I could have just a performance group, you know, these performance groups, and we could perform all over. Well, we wound up performing all over the country, different conventions and stuff. So that, I encourage a lot of teachers to do that. That takes a lot of time and preparation. But then there's a third aspect that I'm also real involved in is either studio, a teacher for just within her own studio will have ensembles, or area-wide within the community to have a big ensemble concert and gather kids from different studios. They all come together and they play ensembles, like for an event, a 6 or 8 week event. So we do that quite a bit too. So it's kind of, you can do it on a small scale or medium or large, I think.
Right. I see that. I might come back to those points in a moment. Well, if you had to define a keyboard ensemble, what would you say and how does it look generally or sound?
Well, nowadays, with such great sample sounds that we have, it's mainly pianists or piano students playing, each of them playing a digital instrument. You know, we can do rock and roll, we can do classical, we can do new age, we can do sound stories, we can accompany singers. So it's mainly kids playing keyboards.
And are they all playing a different sound? So you have someone on a bass and someone on a strings and someone on a clarinet or whatever?
Uh-huh, yes.
Yeah. Right. So it truly is like a band class. And in America, I understand that band is the way that students learn their instrument in most cases. Over here, generally, schools will have private lessons and then the students will go to band rehearsals to come together. And I've conducted bands before and have always enjoyed that experience. And love, one of the things I really like about it is that it, you know, you can't stop the rehearsal with a band of people just because someone hasn't practiced or done their thing. So they've just got to kind of keep, they've just got to keep up, right? And that's one of the things that ensemble playing gives students, particularly piano students who are often just on their own. Do you find that that's a big help for students?
Oh, it's huge. And I'm a, I usually preach to piano teachers, you know, pianists are the worst timekeepers. We cannot keep a steady beat because we always play by ourselves. And when you play with a group, you have to keep up. So when, if we have our piano students play in a group together, they have to really count, really count. And they have to keep going, even if they make mistakes. So it's a great, you know, there's two ways to practice. You can practice practicing and you can practice performing. And it teaches our little students that life will go on, that no one's going to throw rotten tomatoes at you, you know. You keep playing. And it's just a fabulous experience. Then when they come to their individual piano lesson, that I found over the years, their awareness level of not only rhythm, but musicianship, phrasing, all those things, that bar rises because they've had this big group experience. The pianos never get. So it just makes them that much better, I think. And it's fun. What a concept.
and kids, it's fun for everyone. Let's face it. I enjoyed conducting bands and I would imagine that I'd probably get the same energy as you get from a class of students as a teacher in front of a class as you would in an ensemble situation too. Do you find that it helps sight reading?
Oh yes. Oh yes. You can go around, we do lots of improv, you know, in our ensembles. We do all sight reading. Transposition, we do all kinds of those things. So it's just a fabulous opportunity to give piano students.
Yeah, it sounds like an absolute win, in my opinion. So do you see this working? Let's say you're teaching individual students one-on-one and you're happy with that in your studio. Could you see that this could work as a monthly activity that you get a group of students together for an ensemble and they all do that and prepare for perhaps a concert at the end of the year? Uh-huh. I guess the hardest thing about that is having a studio space for it or renting on something.
Yeah, there are lots of factors like that that, you know, are real important in that. But yes, the getting kids together once a month, there are several teachers that do that. I had four groups that rehearsed once a week when I had my big studio, aside from their piano lesson. And we performed all the time. We performed for nursing homes and all kinds of events here in Denton. We performed for national conferences and state conferences. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot of ways to do that. So, but there's a lot of planning that has to go into it for sure.
Yeah, and if you only teach one-on-one and have, like I do, two pianos here, suddenly running something with six kids on ensembles would mean that you'd need to find a lab or hire one or invest in that equipment. Not everyone has the space, of course, too. So do you find that running keyboard labs really works best if you're already teaching groups? Like that's how it makes most sense?
Yeah, usually, because it takes a certain kind of teacher to teach in groups. Not all teachers are geared, you know, to have several kids all playing and doing all the things kids do all at the same time. Of course, you have headphones, but it takes a special kind of group teacher, and that group teacher is easily adaptive to teaching ensembles, having, you know, multitasking at its highest level.
Yes, yeah.
With kids, but it's not impossible. And I've worked with some teachers who've never taught in groups. And once they experience that ensemble, the power of the group dynamic, there's nothing like the power of the group dynamic. Kids learn so much from each other, a lot more than they could ever learn from a single teacher. Some teachers just, they can't believe it and they want to do it. So you have to be a little bit, uncommon. Open to all the things that can happen and go with it. Go with the flow. Have a plan, but be ready to step right out of that plan and go with where the kids are.
Right. And I imagine that a good way to start, potentially, if teachers listening like the idea but are a little bit timid about it, perhaps they could start with just getting two kids together for an ensemble, and then they could get three or four, or, you know, you don't have to jump in and suddenly try and teach a room of 24. In fact, I'd probably, being a school teacher, discourage it.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, well, in the university system, they throw you to the lions right away. So that's what.
Yeah, it's one way to learn. Do you have to know how to conduct to run one of these properly?
It's a good thing, right, to know. But I grew up in the choral world and choirs, you know, and I've always conducted. It's a good thing to be able to conduct. And that's another thing, kids, piano students, when they play on ensembles, they get to experience, you know, us pianists, we're always so down in ourselves, you know, and at the keyboard, we never look up, and that's fine. But to be able to look up and see where a downbeat is and stay with it. And for a teacher to have to conduct, it just increases the teacher's skills, you know, rhythm skills and those type of things. So, but you don't,
absolutely,
you don't have to conduct. There's a lot of percussion teachers. Well, I say percussion teachers today, a lot of elementary schools anyway, in the Texas school system, that get a cabasa or some kind of a tambourine, and instead of conducting, they keep the beat with that. So the kids don't have to watch. And so alternatives, if teachers feel inhibited about, you know, waving their arms around the room and stuff.
I mean, I think it's a good skill for students to be able to look up and get out of the piano while they're playing it, particularly if they're in groups, because knowing from my own small band experience, you have to, eye contact is just so crucial with other musicians. And that's another thing that pianists are so bad at.
Yeah, that's right. A couple of my groups that I'd had for two or three years that rehearsed once a week together, they got to where, you know, we just started and I could just go have lunch or something, because they really enjoyed being in tune with each other and making eye contact and feeling the beat together and all those things. And it was just so exciting, so fun.
It's one reason I like doing two piano things with students, or duets, if nothing else. Yep. And this is something any teacher can do, because one of the first questions that you have to work out with your student is, okay, how are we going to start in time together? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, okay, well, we can count in. So great. So count in. Now, if we're performing, would we count in? Probably not. So how do we tell each other that we're going to start? And that's where the other thing that I learned a lot from accompanying string instrumentalists in particular is, and woodwind is their breathing, and the fact that they'll, and then they'll start playing. And pianists just think you're mad when they say breathe and talk about breathing. I don't know if you found the same thing. They look at me like I'm a complete lunatic. Yeah. But it's so crucial to playing with other people.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah, I've accompanied a lot of horn players at North Texas. And, you listen for them to take a breath and bam, there you are. I mean, that's very easy to do.
Simple musicianship skills that they learn in their first lesson because they have to breathe. Yes. But unless it's explicitly taught to pianists, we often forget to breathe. That's what I find anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about what you need to run a keyboard ensemble, because there's obviously lots of different types of instruments that could be involved. Do you mm-hmm. always use digitals? Do you use acoustics? Do you use some percussion? Do you use technology, apps, iPads?
Yeah, it's wide open now. It used to be, a long time ago, it was all acoustic pianos. It was pretty horrendous. And then, of course, with the great digital pianos, where you could split the keyboard, you could have two kids play one piano and have two different sounds, and even you can change the octave, the placement of the two different instrument sounds on one keyboard. So you can have a middle C up high and a middle C down low.
Right. That's very handy, isn't it? And most digitals would do that today, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Time. But portable keyboards are so inexpensive these days, and the sounds are incredible. And lots of times I'll tell teachers, you know, when they first came out, they were little toy sounds. And, of course, they're small speakers. But now the sampled sounds that you can get in an inexpensive keyboard, and you can hook the keyboard up to a great sound system. And, you know, you can play in a park. You can play in Carnegie Hall. You can play anywhere with these fabulous sounds out of these dinky little keyboards. So it's not that impossible to do.
And do you worry less about the quality of the instrument when you're not sort of teaching touch and tone and phrasing and all that kind of stuff, and you're just getting kids playing in a group together? Is it less important about the touch and the pedal and the weighted keys?
That's a great point, because that's where the uncommon piano teacher comes in, because so many purists, they get pretty upset about the fact that, you know, that they aren't weighted keys. But the opposite side of that coin is most of them are velocity sensitive. So if you press hard, you're going to get a big, full, rich tone. And if you barely play, you're going to get a real puny little almost staccato sound. So there's so many things you can teach about listening, getting the kids listening to the tones, even of different instruments. And, you know, they don't know what a violin is supposed to sound like, or what a clarinet sounds like, or what harmonics on a flute. You know, they have no ideas. We've taught for so many years, to me, in this little piano box, when these instruments that are not weighted keys give us the chance to become aware of all these other ways to create a tone. And so, you know, it's kind of secondary that they are velocity sensitive and are not weighted keys. That's the last thing to worry about, because there's so many other opportunities to teach so many concepts.
It's so refreshing to hear that, Susan, because I thoroughly agree. I would never want my student to be playing on a $200 flimsy keyboard as their primary instrument. but to be able to explore different keyboards, touches, and the different ways of creating sounds, particularly from other instruments. I mean, you're not playing a piano if a French horn sound is coming out. So does the weighted keys really matter in that regard? I think that's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, they're kind of, they don't matter. I mean, it's better to have non-weighted keys. I love explaining to kids, you know, if you're going to play staccato with a clarinet sound, a clarinetist would never go doo, 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 you know, the way you'd play staccato on a piano. So go deep into the key and then get off of it. Like a clarinetist has to get the wind through the instrument before they can let go of the sound. And that's their staccato. And this whole new, you know, the light that comes on in their eyes is so exciting because they really get the concept of staccato. So,
right. Yeah. I can see huge benefits for students, which I've just thought of now, of understanding, well, yes, violins and string instruments tend to play in a more legato fashion because they can and they don't have to breathe between phrases. So that would be a different way of playing to a trumpet who needs to take breaths and pushes lots of air through their instruments and things like that. That's great skills for students to know.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one of the hardest things to teach little pianists is to play a phrase. You know, because you don't have to breathe on the piano to play a phrase. So I love bringing up a flute sound or trumpet, like you said, and explaining, okay, you have to breathe. Where are you going to breathe? Oh, well, here. Well, then lift your finger off the key so you're emulating what a flutist would have to do or a trumpet player. Oh, and then we go to the piano, and you never have to talk about that again because they get it.
Right, yeah. So,
very exciting.
I've been enjoying testing this instrument behind me that you can probably see is a Selviano. It's a new Casio hybrid, which I'll be doing a review on soon. And it just makes me realize that more and more, the reality is that hybrid instruments and digital instruments are going to be only becoming more common. And so I really implore teachers who are still very fixated on students must have an acoustic piano or I will not teach them, to really consider and go and play some of these instruments because they are phenomenal. It is amazing how far they've come along. And I would challenge any person listening to someone playing one of these hybrids to be able to tell the difference.
Yes.
And more and more, go and play one yourself and be able to tell me that it's not an acoustic. Like it's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty amazing. I must digress for a minute and tell you that at one of the conferences several years ago when Yamaha first came out with their Avant Grand or a hybrid piano, they were in the booth next to me at one of the conferences, and Mike Bates, who was head of the institutional division then, loved bringing over usually a university instructor who was, you know, pretty much of a purist and saying, oh, go ahead, sit down. Oh, go ahead, sit down. Well, I don't know. This is, you know, you plug this piano into the wall. I don't know about that. And he would have them sit down and put on headphones. And then about 2 hours later, he'd come back and say, are you done yet? You know, he got the biggest kick out of that. But it's like, don't make up your mind until you sit and work with the instrument for a while, because technology is just amazing.
And even from our last discussion for the last few minutes, realize that if a student has a digital piano and it's a good one, then they're also going to have a whole lot of sounds to use, beats to play with, recording possibilities that it's really easy to forget, number one. But two, they're both positive things that students can use to explore. I don't think I would be where I am now with my piano playing if I hadn't had various digital keyboards and synthesizers when I was younger to play and explore, and I would spend whole weekends recording stuff. And I love that.
The sound palette that kids have today, just in their regular everyday, going to school in the car and everything, is huge. And as much as we love the tone of the piano, that's, you know, I'm sorry, but that's not interesting to a lot of them. So if they have these options of sounds, it's going to draw them in and keep them. And this thing of not teaching kids that don't have an acoustic piano. I would love to ask Yo-Yo Ma if he had a $1 million bow when he was a little kid. You know, James Galway, if he had a gold flute, you know, a mouthpiece. Most fabulous musicians did not start with you know, an excellent instrument. And every child deserves the right to have music, you know, regardless of whether they have. And I always say, I love my digital pianos because I know it's going to be A440.
That's right. Yeah. There goes $200 a year or more in tuning fees too. I hope that piano tuners aren't listening to this. I love my piano tuner.
Yeah. Well, kids will put, like, we'll choose the honky tonk sound, you know, on the clavinova, and they'll say, oh, this is what my piano sounds like at home.
That's when you know they need to be instructed in getting piano tuned.
I mean, if we're going to teach on an instrument, it should sound good. So anyway.
So I want to start wrapping up with a discussion about how to get into this. My first question is, how would you afford the equipment, firstly? And I guess there's one thing we can say is that you've already given a little trick, and that's to split keyboards. So in fact, you can have two kids playing one instrument, one digital piano, and have two instruments coming out of it all in the right register. So that's kind of halved the amount of instruments you think you might need, right?
Yes. Yeah, once you get into it, there's two or three things you can do. Banks are still giving credit lines. So if you made up a very small business plan and, you know, went to your banker and asked for a credit line, now the keyboards are so inexpensive, you really don't need that much money to, if you wanted to invest like in one digital piano and a couple keyboards, or even just one digital piano, like you said, and get the excitement going in your studio. And once you have that excitement going, then you could start like a 6-week ensemble workshop in your studio. And of course, charge for that and use those monies to help pay for keyboards that you would purchase for that. I found if they want to do this, if they start something that's closed-ended with their parents and their parents see, you know, that it's going to end instead of, oh, I'm going to start keyboard ensemble and it's going to go on for years and I'd like for you to participate. You know, parents, they're so used to, you know, events at the end of a program. Anyway, that's one way, you know, to finance multiple keyboards, or even two if you, you know, just got, if you had one digital piano, that could be two kids. And then if you've got two little keyboards, that's four kids.
Right. And they could rotate around them if you want to, you know, give them a chance to play the bigger instrument. Or if you have a clavinova and that's a special one and some lesser quality ones, then you could rotate students through it. I just thought also, do students rehearse their parts just like they're in a band before they come to a group keyboard ensemble?
It depends. These big events that we have with multiple teachers, they have to rehearse it and they have to know their music before they come to the event. There's one we're doing right now in Oklahoma City that started, it goes for 6 Saturdays in a row. The first Saturday, they get their music several weeks ahead of time, of course, so they can start learning it. But we don't expect them to know it perfectly or anything, because part of the fun is growing together, you know, learning the music together and how you're going to practice it differently at home than you do your piano music, your regular solo music. So it varies. It's, you know, it's different depending on what your goal is.
Right. Yeah. And then one of the other jobs of getting everyone together and playing is to balance and get students listening to the different parts and when melody should come out and when they're playing accompaniment, things like that too, right?
That's one of my very favorite things to work on, because once you're into the really working, digging into the music with that, you can talk about, well, if your part goes, oompa, oompa, oom, is that the melody? And the kids will go, well, no, I don't think so. Well, then don't play so loud there. You know, I mean, you can start talking about these things that are commonplace to our instrumental brothers and sisters and our band brothers and sisters that they've never thought of. Then when they have that in their own music, if they advance a little bit and can play, you know, more difficult music or even intermediate music, they get it. They understand that those things. One of my favorite things one little girl said years ago, these were 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds, and we were talking about who has the melody here and who doesn't, and then it switches in the B section and it switches back in the C section. And she said, I get it. This is very intelligent music we're playing, isn't it?
Oh, that's great.
It's so cool because they're kids at that level aren't playing that sophisticated of music, you know, on their for their piano solos, but they can experience that kind of sophistication in a group. So it's very exciting.
Thinking of new things to ask you because I'm getting really inspired by this. The other thing that I'm realizing is that you can have varied abilities in the keyboard ensemble as long as your parts are written appropriately, or you could simplify parts, or the student could do that on the run. Well, that'd be a cool thing to learn too.
Yeah, that's part of the power of the group dynamic. When I was first writing, like I told you, when I was teaching at North Texas, I sat down and wrote a piece that I could play with both hands. And then I dissected that piece for one of the students who could barely play in a five-finger hand position. And then I wrote another, I arranged it. So another part was a kiddo who might be bored just doing that and needed more of a challenge. But it all came out to be the same piece. So that's the, in ensembles that we write now, we usually write two or three parts that are the skill level of the group as a whole. We try to write one part that's a lot easier and another part that's more of a challenge. So you bring in all the kids get to have this experience. The kiddo who can barely play, can barely keep up, can barely count, still can rise to the occasion and experience this level of sophisticated music. And the kiddo who's, they think they can do everything, then they're challenged, you know, to be a leader and don't go too fast, don't do this, don't do that. So that's really the power of the group dynamic is the different skill levels playing together.
Well, you've convinced me, Susan. I think if teachers are listening to this interview and are not considering this as an amazing educational opportunity for their students, I don't know what would make them think about it. I mean, honestly, I always come to interviews with some ideas about my own thoughts on these things, but you've really blown it out of the water with just how many opportunities can come from students playing together in a group. And I keep thinking back to my work as a band conductor and as an accompanist and seeing what students who are playing in solo line instruments are doing, wind and brass. And we just, our students don't get that opportunity unless they do something like this. So I really appreciate all the ideas that you've come up with and reminded us about.
Yeah.
So what are the best digital pianos to buy? We've talked about the fact that you can really start anywhere, but if you had the money and you could invest, what would you recommend?
Well, you know, I'm going to say Yamaha's Clavinova.
Right.
And
why do you like those?
And I do for two reasons. The sound, the quality of their samples is just excellent. Yamaha makes one of the finest acoustic pianos in the world. And so that's what they have to sample for their piano sound. And the, of course, the range of their sounds, they have extended general MIDI. They have, you know, 700 or 800 voices on one digital piano that you have to choose from. And the feel of the instrument, that was the thing that convinced me in the 1980s to get a Clavinova. I couldn't believe how it felt. And, you know, it's not an acoustic piano. Some people think, well, it's not acoustic. Well, it isn't trying to be an acoustic piano. It's a digital piano. But you can change the feel of the action by 5 gradations on the Clavinova. You can make it feel real hard, like a 9-foot grand. You can make it feel real easy, like a 100-year-old upright for people with arthritis and that have trouble playing. So I like the way it feels because it's really close to a piano. But once again, on those different sounds, you're able to articulate the sound of that instrument by the action of the instrument. And it's just real user-friendly.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I'm pretty techy and I look at a Clavinova and I freak out. And it's like an airline, aeroplane cockpit to me. But I know you have courses, which I want to ask you about just in just a moment to help people with that. What does a Clavinova? I know there's many various models. What's the approximate cost of a Clavinova?
Well, if you get one of the higher end models, I think they range around $9,000 or $10,000. It depends on where in the country, the United States, you purchase it. You know, some areas are less expensive than others. So, but there are Clavinovas that a new Clavinova in the lower range of the series are probably, I think, $5,000 or $6,000.
Right. Okay. So yeah, it's a fair investment. There's no doubt about that. But I think you could go online and very quickly find out all there is to know about them. And having played one, I agree with you. They are great to play. They feel good and they sound good even without headphones. The sound system is very good and the beats and backing tracks are very good, I think.
Yeah.
What about music? Where do you find music for students to play?
Ensemble music?
Right.
Well, we have... We have about 300 or 400 ensembles on our website. I don't know if anybody else is writing or arranging anymore. I know some have, and we publish a lot of their music now. Ogilvy Music does, but Hal Leonard has some great ensembles that go with each of their method book skill levels that Philip Kevren has done.
And right, okay.
It's Philip Kevren. You can't get any better than Philip Kevren.
Oh, hey, I do not know how he produces so much music. It's just
amazing.
Unbelievable. His output is phenomenal. Yeah. All right. So, Tool, tell us about your website. Where do people find out more about the sheet music, firstly?
Well, I have two websites, and the one with all the ensembles is called SoSpace. It's like my initials, SoSpace.com. Right.
Right, great. And so you also have resources for teachers who would like to know more about Clavinovas, right? So tell us about that quickly.
And that's at ogilvymusic.com. I have
several
sections there of that website, but one is All Things Clavinova, where you can learn all about the Clavinova. I have a little Clavinova Minutes that you can watch just one little aspect of one feature or function of the Clavinova. I have a lot of ideas that I've done at our seminar where you met Claudia and Karen at the KETS seminar that they on how to use the Clavinova to teach. I always say it's your best teacher's aid. And I've only had time to put up two or three videos about that at ogilvymusic.com, but I hope to really expand that and put up a lot more things because a lot of teachers just look at it and see all the buttons and don't understand how to
freak out like I do. Yeah. Which is kind of weird because I remember driving synthesizers back when I was a boy and they had wooden end sides and things like that. So they weren't particularly easy to use. Look, I know it would just be a matter of sitting down for a few hours and getting stuck into it. I'd work it out reasonably quickly. I hope others would find the same. Yeah. But your seminars, so you hold them each year, I believe. It's called KETS, Keyboard Ensemble, remind me.
Keyboard Ensemble and Technology Seminar.
Right, mm-hmm. And that's held where?
Right now it's held at the University of Central Oklahoma, which is just north of Oklahoma City.
Right, and that's each summer?
Yes, each June. It's an outgrowth of the Yamaha educational seminars that Yamaha used to sponsor around the country for about 15 years, a long time ago.
So. Great. So if you would like to know more about Clavinovas and getting the most out of that, then definitely Susan is the person to go to. I've heard that from many, many people.
Wow.
And if you're looking to start the ensembles and you want to just get in at the less expensive end of the spectrum, you can buy, as we've talked about, some relatively simple digital pianos and grab some music from sospace.com, which is Susan's site for sheet music for ensembles. And I know my good friend Paul Myatt, who has been on the show before, he has some keyboard ensembles. So we'll find a link for his ones as well.
Right.
He's rearranged some traditional classical pieces.
Right.
So I'll pop a link to that in the show notes for everyone. Look, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your time today, Susan. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you. Thank you for sharing so many ideas.
Thank you, Tim. This is great. what you're doing.
I appreciate it. And hopefully you'll head to Susan's website. And remember too that we've also started a series whereby you can get updates on these new podcast episodes and any new articles I write straight into your Facebook Messenger. It's a one-click process. If you'd like to do that and get all of this stuff out of your inbox, which is might be overflowing with other stuff, just go to timtopham.com/Facebook. You can click the button and I'll just pop up in your Messenger whenever I have a new episode. As I've already mentioned, the show notes, the links, and all our resources for today's episode will be at timtopham.com/episode106. And this is actually the last episode in Group Teaching Month. I do hope you have enjoyed all the things we've covered this month on the blog and the podcast. I hope it's given you some ideas to think about. If you are already a group teacher, hopefully you'll be able to get some confidence in what you're doing and keep developing your studio. And if you are looking to make the move across, then hopefully you've got some ideas about how that could be done. Next week, we kick off a month's focus on all things aural. That's A-U-R-A-L. I know with my accent, it might sound a little bit different over in the United States. Susan, correct me if I'm wrong. So all things aural, improving our oral skills as teachers, and also how to improve our students' oral skills with activities and things that actually engage them. Because I find one of the things I know students need to know about most is they need to have a good ear. But a lot of the activities we use to build their ear aren't really engaging and don't last very long for them. So one of the things I'm going to show you, in fact, on next week's podcast, I'm going to show you how to simplify and teach a pop song by ear. I think this is a great skill for any teacher to have. And I'm going to show you at the piano exactly what I do with an example song that a student brought to me not long ago. So that's next week on the podcast. Until then, I wish you all the best in your teaching. Thank you again, Susan, and farewell, everyone.
We'll conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon Piano Podcast for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.